Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Dyslexia Life Hacks Show. I'm your host, Matthew Head. And in this episode, I'm talking to Philip Ruddock. He's the founder of Our Dyslexic Connection, which is an online resource that has video stories from dyslexic people to connect them together and share experiences. I will be posting a video of myself on this website soon. His full-time job is actually as an English teacher for Middlesbrough College. English teacher is not the first thing I'd have thought of for a job for a dyslexic person. So it's going to be really interesting to dig into that. I will, of course, post links to Our Dyslexic Connection, as well as other things we talk about in the show notes, which will be available at dyslexialifehacks.com/podcast. Welcome to the show, Phil.
Thank you for having me.
No worries. So I noticed when I was digging through your LinkedIn profile that you have a master's in inclusion and special education lead from, was it Queen's University, I think it was.
Yep.
What made you want to dive into that?
The master's was a small part of a longer story. So to kind of give you the full context of that, I'd always wanted to be an English teacher.
Okay.
My secondary English teacher was amazing. He would get us to do independent tasks, and one of them was The Hobbit. And as we were reading through The Hobbit, he would draw out The Hobbit, and he would draw out all the characters as you went around the class reading it out. So as you were reading about Gandalf, Gandalf would just appear as he drew it out, and it was just incredibly engaging.
Yeah, that's amazing.
It was. It was really... I'm very undyslexic with my dyslexia. I love reading.
Right.
Because the world it creates in my head is so vivid.
Mm.
So when I was seeing like the characters appear, I was like, that's the job I want. Didn't quite go to plan.
Okay.
So went off, did my undergrad in English of all things.
Mm-hmm.
And then didn't get on my PGCE course. Then I was told at a Russell's Group University interview that I will never become an English teacher because you're dyslexic. How could you teach English when you can't spell? Literally, that was in front of like the group discussion. And then I had more of that during the one-to-one interview.
So ritual humiliation.
Basically, yes. And just an ever so small smattering of discrimination.
yes.
Yeah. And that led me to go back to my old secondary school and start working there. One of the things I did was set up my own dyslexia mentoring system from the ground floor up over of what I would have wanted. And after about 4 years, I knew that there was stuff that I was missing. There was stuff that when I was talking with the students, who came to me with D's and E's and left me with A stars to C. And incredibly confident young people that were at one point saying they would never go to university were now changing their minds and going off to uni. And I didn't know enough. So I started searching through, well, how could I do this? Where could I go that could teach me more about dyslexia, more about what I wanted to know? And at that point in time, Queen's University Belfast was the only place that did what I wanted to research and what I wanted to learn about. So ended up moving over there for about a year and a bit and studying about dyslexia and studying about trauma in the lives of children and how trauma impacts and on all different aspects of learning. And it was really enriching and it kind of answered a lot of the questions, but there were still other bits that I was trying to delve into.
Mm.
And my research was on dyslexia and identity and how the label of dyslexia creates our identity, but also self-esteem and self-confidence. And how the words we use can either empower us or disempower us.
Okay.
And it was just incredibly, incredibly interesting, at least for a geek like me.
So what's the example of kind of words that we would use as dyslexic people that would disempower us versus the empowering ones?
Noticing a lot of students, and I did it myself a lot, and I still catch myself doing it. I'm in no way perfect. And how I view dyslexia is kind of like an ever-living apprenticeship.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting.
Saying that we're not enough, I can't do that. Yes. And being aware of the self-talk and the negativity that we sometimes feed into, and that kind of idea of disablement that we kind of, oh, I can't do that. Oh, no, I can't. And shying away and reducing who we are. And also, pivotally, the idea of enough. And like, what are the three most difficult words to say in the English language?
Darling.
It's not, I love you. That's very vulnerable.
Yes.
It's not, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
It's, I am enough.
Wow.
And
okay.
Owning those three words and truly owning them is one of the most liberating experiences possible. Knowing that you're enough just as you are in your imperfect perfection.
Yeah. Yeah.
And having those conversations with, no, you are enough. You're not broken.
No.
You don't need fixing. And those are some of the words that, like, brokenness, needing to be fixed, what's wrong with me? A lot of the stuff that the students come out with, the inherent idea that there is something wrong with them, something broken, something that needs fixing.
Yeah.
Because they don't fit into the mold that they think we should have.
Yeah, yeah. So what do you find when people come round to the idea that they are enough? Does it allow them to release the shackles of it? Or do you find they grow into a bigger thing? I'm trying to think of it from both ways. It's almost like letting go of the deficits. I refer to it as self-limiting beliefs quite a lot, and I've had quite a few of them through my 20s. But now in my late 30s, I now start seeing the benefit of it and pushing the dyslexic skills forward to drive my life, career, and other things forward. So I'm interested to see how, once people start coming around to that realization, what gets them further forwards.
Once they begin to accept, and one of the things I'll never, ever forget when I was working at the secondary school was one of the students at that point in time, was his life was boxing.
Oh, cool.
Boxing came first. Everything else came secondary.
Gives him meaning. And,
sorry?
Gives him meaning.
That was his life. It was the way he de-stressed. It was the way that he dealt with the stresses and the strains of being dyslexic. He went after school and did a couple of rounds of boxing. And when we were researching role models, when we were researching dyslexic people, the fact that he found out that Muhammad Ali, his absolute idol, was dyslexic. And he was like, I'm like him. And it was just that incredible moment where things just settled with this person. And the angriness and the anger that this person used to have just began to ebb away. And they're like, if they can do it, I can do it. And it's kind of having that link and that ability to have somebody kind of go, oh, well, I'm not alone.
Yes, yes.
And they begin to step into themselves far, far more, and they begin to kind of trust themselves. And I had one student I used to work with. It's odd. I've never experienced it before.
Okay.
Because everybody's brains work differently and everyone's dyslexia is individualistic to them.
Yes.
But every so often, there's a bit of like a dyslexic overlap, and where like the dyslexics tend to find each other.
Yes, I've noticed that.
And we tend to find each other. We tend to have like conversations where we know what we're talking about, but very few people other do.
Oh, yes.
And that's when it touches. The dyslexia kind of just nudges against each other. Where with this person, their dyslexia was very much like my dyslexia.
Okay.
So when I was teaching them, we didn't really need to kind of talk that much. It just made sense. And one of the things they used to do was they'd learned not to trust themselves.
Yes. Yep.
They'd learned that they were wrong. So they would whisper the word as they were reading, right, and then discount the fact that they were right and say out loud wrong. Because they couldn't be right.
Oh, I see. Okay. Wow.
So we had to kind of like begin to break that down and kind of go, no, when you whisper it, it's correct. you're reading it correctly.
Yeah.
But you're doubting yourself to such a degree that you're then coming out. And it's kind of like, I don't know, it was an interesting kind of reinforcement of the negativity, even though they were getting it right.
Yeah, yeah. They've so sold themselves on the idea that they're always wrong with it, that they can't possibly ever be right.
Yes. And it took a long time. It took around about 4 months of just kind of going, no, you can do this. Let's just break it down. No, don't doubt yourself. Say it again, but say that whisper just a little bit louder.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit louder again. And I'd never come across that.
Yeah, that's it. But it's really interesting because that's quite a sort of tangible example of, I don't know if you've ever had this, but the internal dialogue, isn't it? I can't possibly be right with this. And I know I would have done sat in a classroom. It's going around in my head. So you never see it on the outside. It's interesting that person made it quite tangible for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was interesting. I've never experienced it before. So it's one of those kind of memories that stick in my head of how dyslexia can kind of play out in different ways and how it can affect mindset and belief concepts. And as we kind of were talking with this student, what had happened is they were incredibly intelligent, but they'd been put into the bottom set of school and left.
Yep. Yep.
So they'd learned...
One sympathizes.
Yeah, they'd literally learned that, well, I can't do this because I'm in the bottom set.
Yeah. Yeah.
And because they hadn't had the intervention, because they hadn't had someone sit with them, they just learned that they were wrong. When they weren't. And it was that frustration of intellect and a need to learn with the want of, will someone help me? Am I making sense there?
You are, like, yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's sorry, I'm a bit silent because it's very close to home.
Sorry.
I was like, wow, yeah, yeah. I've been there. So did this student know they were dyslexic quite early on in their life, or was it something you picked up during your lesson?
It was a class that there was about 20 of them. And then by the end of the year, a strong percentage of that class were diagnosed.
And that's you spotting it in them, is it?
It wasn't so much me spotting it. It was also me kind of just going through the process of getting them assessed.
Okay.
But this person didn't know until they were in college.
Wow. So they just think there's something in brackets wrong with them, but what is actually wrong with them, and I'm doing the air quotes with my fingers for everybody on audio, is they think differently and I'm being given the wrong tools to learn.
Yes.
With. Yeah.
And at that point, the automatic assumption is they're stupid.
Oh, yes. Unfortunately.
And then when you begin to open up that particular word, and this is where I get quite geeky, and one of the parts of the masters came in with labeling theory.
Go on.
And labeling theory basically says that, like, words come in pairs.
Okay.
So you've got, if you label yourself as stupid, you apply all of the other synonyms of stupid to yourself, but you discount all of the opposite words, so of clever, of intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
So if you say, I am, whatever it is that follows it, you're opening yourself up to all of those synonyms. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
And then removing all of the potential positives, because words work in binary opposites.
Yes. Yes, they do, don't they? So yeah, I am stupid. And it's not like, it's not even I am stupid at English. It's just I am stupid.
Yes.
So you don't think of, hey, but I'm great at, I don't know, fixing cars or science or whatever. Like, yeah, I was really good at science at school, but my lasting memory etched on my head at school is being rubbish at English.
But we then got the societal kind of like underpinning of maths and English, which really irritates me. Like, turning around and saying that you're bad at maths is so far in the UK a badge of honour and a badge of pride.
It is, yes. Yeah, yeah.
But no way would you turn around and say, and bad at English because it's an idea of shaming.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
There is a societal stigma of shame attached to being bad at English, never mind when you put on top of that dyslexia.
Yeah. 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 It is, isn't it? It's really interesting. And I've talked to previous guests about this, where it is interesting how English is held in a slightly different level to everything else. And you are right. Like, I'm bad at maths. So you pull your phone out and tap it in the calculator.
Yes.
But you don't go, I'm bad at English. Pull your phone out and ask its personal system how to spell the word, which is the same thing. It's using assistive technology. It's just with English, not maths. Like, you sort of hide the fact, or I used to anyway. And then you don't get any help with it, do you?
No, and then shame reinforces shame.
It does, yeah.
And then the more that you feel the shame, the more that you hide the shame, so that you feel more shame at the fact that you're hiding the shame with shame.
Yes, yes.
and it kind of creates that kind of cyclical...
Spiral, yes.
Spiral, and it creates a shame storm.
Oof, shame storm, good word to use.
It came from Brené Brown.
Okay.
Who, incredibly good researcher, and fitted so well into dyslexia. She doesn't research dyslexia. She's based in America and she researches trust, shame, and vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
But when you apply her concepts to dyslexia, it fits.
Oh, okay. Yes. Yeah. So it's the negative self-belief side. Oh, I have to look that up.
And how shame works and how trust works and how vulnerability works. And for a dyslexic, one of the most vulnerable things is opening ourselves up and asking somebody, is that the right spelling?
Yeah.
It's a way, it's very vulnerable.
It is.
We're putting a lot of trust in that person not to shame us.
Yes. Yes. We are. And I think as an adult, it's less of a problem, and depends on your environment.
Mm-hmm.
I've discovered, having worked in multiple different types, but at school, no way. I would quietly, subtly ask my close friends next to me.
Yeah. But even then, if one of those close friends was having a bad day and kind of did an eye movement or an eye roll or some sort of grimace when you were asking, unintentionally, that could cause shame.
Yes, yes. Yeah, you pick up on the subtle body language, even though it's... Yes. Yeah, and it's hard. I guess once you're in the shame storm, it's quite hard to think sort of rationally in terms of they're just having a bad day, or they're stressed, or they're finding this task hard as well, let alone me asking them, how does this word spell kind of thing?
Yeah. And as well at that point, like, teenagers seem to be very much about... It's all focused on their lives because it's what's happening.
Yes.
And it's having that level of introspection that you grow into as you get older and as you mature.
Yeah, yeah.
But at that point, they might not have that introspection, that maturity to kind of think, right, they're having a bad day, because the shame then takes over.
Yeah, because everybody's the main character in their own personal movie, and it takes a fair bit of age and wisdom and experience to realize that everybody else is kind of doing the same things.
Yeah, and it's kind of just being able to take a step back and think, right, they're having a bad day. This wasn't about me.
Yes.
It was them. It's all good.
It's all good. Yes. Yeah. So what about your dyslexia story? How old were you, and when did you find out you were dyslexic? How did that come about?
I found out that I was dyslexic when I was doing my undergrad. So it was in the second year.
Yeah.
I'd been a splud for spelling since primary school.
A splud for spelling?
Yes. A specific learning difficulty, spelling.
Right.
So I was really bad at spelling. Nothing else linked. I was just bad at spelling. It didn't explain why I bumped into things. It didn't explain why I couldn't catch, or apparently I run weirdly. Not that I run that often now.
Do you Phoebe out friends, right?
I think so. That's kind of how the pitch is. It's not quite like that. But apparently, like, it didn't explain any of my coordination, how I couldn't tie my shoelaces, how I was incredibly forgetful.
Mm-hmm.
or why I daydreamed all of the time. I was just really bad at spelling. And it just didn't really help having the splud because it meant nothing.
Yeah. Yeah, I've never even heard of that. Like, just really zeroed in on one thing. Because yes. you'd think that'd be a little bit of an early warning flag. Hey, let's check some other things.
Yeah, and they never did that. I was sent to, like, I really didn't like them because it never really helped. But in primary school and in secondary school, you were like lumped into a class outside of, you're not, so you were giving up like a lunchtime or you were giving up a break yep. time.
Yep.
And you'd be sent into like a group of people to do like handwriting tasks or spelling tasks.
Yeah.
And all of you would be given a personalized, empty, like wooden book.
Yeah.
Like going back in though, and I can still remember it was blue and it had like that tape along the spine of the book and it had like two bits of wood. And that was going to be your personalized dictionary where you're going to put all of your words that you couldn't yeah. do in the dictionary.
yeah.
And as a kid, I'm sat there thinking, I can't spell the word in the first place. How am I supposed to put it into my own dictionary?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But you were like, every single person was enforced to use this.
Yep.
And it was like, it was a strategy that was incredibly well-intended. And the lady that was doing it was really lovely. And she was genuinely very sweet. But I'm sat there thinking, this isn't going to work for me, but I've got to use it.
Yeah. Yeah, you end up just doing it to not get in trouble for not doing it.
Yes.
Yeah.
100%. But it wasn't until my second year of university where I sat in front of the Ed Psych for 4 hours doing the assessment. And it was like the atypical Ed Psych. Like, white hair, checkered shirt, corduroy trousers, like that whole like stereotypical
Ed Psych type. Oh, right. Yeah, mine was my second Ed Psych assessment. She was nothing like that.
Right. He was lovely. And basically after the 4 hours where I felt as if my brain had leaked out of my ears.
Yeah, yeah.
Like no personal training session at the gym has ever quite matched the level of like exhaustion that an Ed Psych test does.
Yeah.
And basically said, you're dyslexic, but here's your IQ. And kind of explained both things to me. And at the end of that, I was like, so I'm not stupid. I was like, and he looked at me to kind of go, did you hear anything I just told you? And I was like, I need you to tell me, like, I'm not stupid. He's like, no, you're not stupid. That's your IQ test. You are dyslexic. You cannot be stupid. And for me, that was the kind of the beginning, the turnaround of that mindset of, hold on a minute. I'm not stupid. I've got a document that's like half an inch to an inch thick telling me that I'm not.
Not stupid. Yeah. Yeah.
And that, and those kind of like negative connotations began to kind of melt away. Now it wasn't perfect.
No.
But yeah, that was a turning point in my mindset for me.
So what would you be like 21, 22 at that point?
Ooh, yeah, about that.
Okay. So yeah, I had a similar thing when I got stapled at 6, but had to redo my Ed Psych assessment when I went to uni as a mature student. And the IQ test is like, wow, not stupid. And her reply was far from it because your dyslexia lowers the score in this IQ test. I'm like, wow, okay.
Yeah.
So you would have done that second year of uni. Did you then start getting all the tools in place to help you with your degree studies past this moment?
Yeah, I ended up getting one-to-one support, which was a complete revelation to me.
Mm.
And it was both incredibly useful, but also utterly infuriating. Because incredibly useful that finally I was getting the help and support that I always needed. And my university grades just accelerated. And the level of kind of like my academic writing just leapt off the page and was incredibly good, because I'd always been told you've got A-star thoughts in your head, Phil, but as they go down your arm, they go down in grid. Like, awesome, thank you. Lovely metaphor, but teach me how to.
Yeah. What's the problem with my arm? Fix the arm.
Yeah, fix the arm. Get the stuff from my head onto the page so I get the grades.
I like that metaphor. And
it was infuriating, because why did I have to wait until university to get this support that technically should have been put in at secondary?
Yeah.
Like, GCSEs are the gatekeepers to your education, to your career.
They are.
So why was I getting that support after I'd kind of belly crawled through education and scraped into university? Why wasn't it there? Why wasn't it when I needed it the most?
It's a shame as well, because majority of the guests in this podcast have the same experience where they find out in university and you start. It's not a panacea, because I got stigmatized when I was young. And you still have the battle. Mm-hmm. But at least I kind of knew what it was. And yes, I've got quite a lot of the negative, did have quite a lot of the negative stuff that you've mentioned, particularly your students. I found it really hard to listen to, because it was really quite close to home. But why are other people like yourself, you picked up for having poor spelling, why are they not testing for dyslexia? So at least, because the GCSEs are, as you say, the gatekeepers to college, the gatekeepers to university. You kind of judge by that one summer.
Yes.
For quite a lot of your higher education needs, unless you do take a break and come back as a mature student. Quite a lot of people don't want to do that. So everybody needs the tools, don't they? And they need the best chance they can.
They need the best chance they can. And because the GCSEs are so pivotally important, they need that support at that point in time. And equally, if you then expand upon that viewpoint, how many people at 16 are already sick of education and have gotten fed up of being in education? They can't do it, so they fall out of school. They're truant. They get bad behavior. They get into other behaviors that lead them down a very different path.
A very dark path for some people,
yes,
as well.
And why are those people missing out on the support? Like, if they had that support at 11, their lives could be very, very different.
Yes. Yeah.
People that have ended up in prison, people that have ended up in different, like, just if they had that support, that their life path might have been incredibly different.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's a frustrating problem, isn't it? It's just, yeah. Why can't everybody get the support they need to not end up taking dark paths? Or even just, like, I didn't take a dark path. I just ended up in a career that wasn't right for me.
But you get so many young people that are so angry. And they're 16 and they shouldn't be that angry.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's the, like, you're a kid for such a short amount of time, but an adult for such a long amount of time.
Yes.
You should be able to enjoy your childhood as best as possible, with as much support as possible, to become as happy and as prosperous as you could be. And so it was really, really infuriating to me that support came in at university, when it should have been at secondary level.
Yeah. And I imagine it sounds like you more or less went from scraping a pass at your degree course to getting quite decent grades within months.
Yes, literally within months. The dyslexia tutor literally sat down with me and taught me how to actually... One of the things I used to do is literally just empty my head into a paragraph.
Yeah, okay.
So she literally taught me, right, that this bit here is one point. There's another point. There's another point. So one paragraph of mine originally would then turn into three or four paragraphs with individual points.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
And she was incredibly good at being able to teach me how to do that. And I'll never forget her name, and I'll never forget how she helped me with that, because it was just like, oh, wow, that's what I've been wanting to do. It just never kind of, I could never manage it until she pointed it out.
Yeah. Did you have any other support with like assistive tech or any other, or was it mostly the coaching?
It was mostly the coaching at that point in time. I mean, I was given Read, Write, Gold. I was given all of the bits and pieces. I was given a voice recorder.
Oh, yes. Yeah,
which I used quite a lot of. And that was quite handy, mainly because I would record the lectures for me, but then send it out to all of my friends. So it was like...
For exchange of beer and sweets, right?
Yes, entirely. Actually, yes, it really was. But it was really useful in that way, because then we'd all go to the students' union, we'd play some of the zombie shooting games, you know, like the old arcade ones.
Yeah,
gather around for like a burger and a pint, listen to the lecture that's just been recorded, and make the notes all over again.
Oh, nice. You were popular.
It was handy. But the other, like the Read, Write, Gold, and I wasn't in the right frame of mind at that point to use it. I was still kind of accepting dyslexia.
Yes, yeah.
And kind of going through that process of, if it fits for me and it's sneaky and I can hide it, then I'll work with it.
Yeah.
Where Read, Write, Gold was a little bit too out there.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. It was a little bit too, like, sign above the head.
Yes.
And I was still kind of growing into the accent. I'd got the label, but it took a lot of internalizing and a lot of time kind of unpacking all of those years and all of those issues before I kind of got confident and going, dyslexic. I'm going to use this and I'm going to do this.
Yes. Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, the label is not necessarily, and it's totally wrong that people think this, but they don't necessarily see it in a positive light either. So you've got to unpack your own, I imagine you've got to unpack your own personal things when you found out as a 20-year-old, like all this stuff suddenly snaps into place through your school years. And then how do I fit in the world as a dyslexic person? Who do I tell? Who do I not tell? And
yes.
Yeah. And everybody's going to think I'm stupid, which they're not.
Yeah. And it can't. Yeah. You're entirely correct. And at that point, and it wasn't until years later. I mean, I was coming out at that point as well. And I was having to tell people that I was gay and all of that kind of aspect.
Mm-hmm.
And then it didn't kind of dawn on me until good few years later that at the same time as I was coming out, I was also telling people I was dyslexic and coming out as dyslexic.
Okay, yeah.
And it kind of has its own, a very similar crossover.
Really?
And being able to turn around and go, yeah, I'm dyslexic, this is what it means for me, is the exact same like process when you come out as gay. At least for me. I mean, I can't talk about everybody, but...
No.
But it's that worry of, am I going to be shamed? Is somebody still going to like me?
Yes.
Are they going to do that whole head tilt and go, oh. Like, which we're all very aware of, is that particular O sound and the head tilt and that look of, oh, bless you.
Yeah.
And it does have that kind of like crossover and being able to accept yourself and embrace who you are. And find the power and kind of the courage to be you.
Yes, yes. I could see the analogy. Yeah, and that kind of thing with like negative people, isn't it? Like maybe you just don't need to be around them anymore.
Yes, I don't need to be around you. You're not going to accept me for who I am now that I've told you. Okay, over you go, and I'll go in this path.
Yeah, it's something I've discovered, particularly since doing all the dyslexia work I do now, that the more authentic I am, the better connection I have with people. And it's like... Telling the 20-year-old me that would have not flown at all.
No. But it's that growth into yourself.
It is, yes.
And it's kind of shedding that emotional baggage and that mental baggage.
Yes.
And
yes.
I mean, me doing that over the years has taken me going to three bouts of counselling, two bits of hypnotherapy and using a therapeutic coach. And a life coach. So it's kind of been a battle and a half, but one that is very, it served me incredibly well.
Do you find, and it's going to sound really odd, but so I'm quite a tall, broad person, but there was one point where I suddenly felt like I fitted my body properly and it stood up properly rather than feeling like a small person in a big person's body, if that makes any sense
to you? It makes perfect sense. It makes absolute sense. It really, really does. And oddly enough, I've had conversations similar. And can you remember when you made gingerbread men?
Yes.
When you were little and you had the gingerbread cutter?
Yes.
It's kind of like that, isn't it? You've got the cookie cutter shape of who you want to grow into, but you haven't quite hit the edges of the cookie cutter shape.
Right. Yes. Yes. Yeah.
You're kind of growing steadily. Sorry, I'm incredibly visual. So
me too. Too.
We're you're growing here. Into that shape.
Yeah.
And having conversations with some of my students going, you will get there. You are growing into yourself.
Mm.
And sometimes it might take you a bit longer and other times it might happen really, really quickly.
Yeah.
But you're entirely right. You do kind of feel all of a sudden as if you're in your own body and you kind of, you're the right shape and size and it fits. But it's not actually your body that you're referring to. It's just like your general sense of self.
Yeah, it's the internal kind of perception, is it? But they say, don't they, what you see in the mirror is not what everybody else sees.
Yes. Yeah. 100%. And that's something that I've struggled with a lot. And I think one of the things, and this might be a broad sweeping statement that I'm about to make, I think a lot of dyslexic people don't see themselves clearly.
Mm. I think there is a lot to that statement that, carrying the baggage from childhood and stuff does skew your own self-perception.
Yes. And people turn around and go, oh, you're amazing at this. Am I? And it's kind of like, I think as well, accepting praise can be quite difficult for a dyslexic.
Yep.
Because for me, one of the quickest ways to freak me out is to give me praise. Because yes. I can accept it to a degree, but if it is like on certain subjects, no, I get really, really weeded out. Even though the person's been genuinely lovely, it's something that I still need to work on.
Yes. Yeah. It is. And I discovered doing various talks and stuff recently that what I pass off is just getting on with it. So, no, that was quite a clever thing you did then, or that's quite a good thing. And it's like, but it's just what you need to do to get the problem solved and the situation sorted.
Mm.
Yeah, but you did it. Oh. Okay, fair enough. Just stop underselling it.
But equally, it's just kind of like it becomes natural to you, doesn't it?
Yes. Yeah, I think it's the interesting thing with being a dyslexic person. What comes naturally comes so easy that you almost don't. It's hard to sort of look in the mirror and realize that actually this is a thing you have over other people, so to speak, an advantage you have over them because you're so used to hearing the disadvantages that you. It's like, hang on, maybe I'm just good at this, like a lot good at this.
Yeah, you just don't realize it, do you? Because as you said, you're so focused on trying to like sort out the negative parts or kind of build bridges over them that you forget about what you're actually really good at.
Yes. Yeah.
And you take it for granted.
Yeah. You do. Yeah. Well, it's just what you do, isn't it? Like, you shrug your shoulders and get on with it. And it's like, but it's not just what everybody does. I kind of want to move on to your job as an English teacher. We've kind of talked about it to contextualize the rest of it. You kind of mentioned you went back and studied your master's. You were struggling to get into an English teacher scheme. So how did you eventually end up becoming a full-blown English teacher?
It took around about 10 years.
Wow.
Yeah. I don't seem to do anything easily. Nothing ever comes easily for me in my life, it seems. Okay. I seem to be hitting a lot of walls all of the time. I came back from Belfast. I was unemployed for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I managed to get a job at Middlesbrough College. And I became a learning support assistant.
Oh, yes.
And I did that for well, 8 years. And I enjoyed it. And then I ended up getting into my 30s and began to think, there's just me. I need a bit more money. I need to kind of begin to make a bit of wiggle room and kind of get on the housing ladder and all of it. Like, I've been adulting light. I need to do the whole full fat adulting.
Yeah.
I've been living like...
Yeah.
So COVID kind of hit. And at that point, the government produced the catch-up fund.
Yes.
So I did a year as a learning and pastoral coach for English and kind of delivering one-to-one. But previously, I'd been working and kind of helping other students and teaching one-to-one. So it was kind of a natural progression. And delivered that, really enjoyed it. And then it was a case of, there's an English job coming up, go do it. And the person who was my mentor was and is entirely responsible for everything that is about to happen and has been happening this year. Because she basically turned around to me and went, what are you doing? You can do this. Get on with it. And it was kind of like that... that tough love type of stop overthinking it, just get it done, get in the classroom, you can do this.
Yeah, get it done. Yeah.
Get it done. I'd already done my PGC while I was a learning support assistant. And when I was kind of like learning how to group teach, that person's voice from the university kept appearing in my head. Like, and it was that self-doubt. Am I doing this? Can I do this? And constantly having to kind of go back and go, did I do this right? Am I doing this right? And I didn't realize that it was that professor's voice that was still kind of lingering in the subconscious. And it was at Christmas that I began to shed that voice. And then it was about 3 weeks ago when I actually passed my first, like my overall, you can teach rubber stamped.
Oh, nice, cool.
The voice basically just went.
Yes, yes.
And letting go of that perception back when I was 23, 24, maybe. And that lingering kind of subconscious doubt just went. I'm 36 now. And that's been incredibly freeing.
Yes, I can. Yes, well, I don't have to imagine. I know. So, yeah, it's these lingering voices. I wonder how many lives they hold back.
Well, they held mine back because, and I didn't realize it until Christmas. 4 years ago, I had a meeting with a PR consultant about my website. And she was like, this is amazing. This is going to go really far. We can go global with this. We can get you on this morning, on TV, on radio, on everything. And I ran away as fast as I could, metaphorically, into my cave, dug a new cave within the cave and hid.
Oh, interesting.
Because I, at that point, was harkening back to, how can you do this? You're dyslexic.
Yeah.
How can you do this?
Yeah. Yeah.
And hid away from it until I got COVID. And it was, I got Delta. I was in hospital for about 12 hours. And I was sat in there thinking, what are you doing, Phil? Like, you're in hospital. What are you doing? You need to actually get back to this website. And then... it kind of all happened all at once. I started doing the website at the same time as the voice began to go because I knew I could teach. And that's how I've then begun to have meetings with the people I've been having meetings with. And it was just incredibly freeing in a way that I've tried explaining to my teaching mentor how fundamentally like life-altering, redefining, I'm not quite sure I can encapsulate the emotion of it. It was that she gave me.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's getting, like, I'm getting a bit emotional while I'm trying to kind of like encapsulate it. But it was one of those moments where someone did something that they probably thought was just, it's my job. It's nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. They think it's a small slap on the back. Get on with it. And
yeah,
it's a huge thing for you.
Yeah. I don't quite know. And I kind of pride myself at times of being able to spin a little bit of a good description. But I don't think I can actually articulate it with any level of significance that it needs to have.
And I think that has power on its own. I hope people who are listening can sort of feel that the fact you're struggling to articulate properly shows just how much effect it had on yourself.
Yeah, it really did. And it was just incredibly freeing. I mean, will I be an English teacher forever? I don't know. I've got plans that I'd like to act out and go forward with.
But yes.
Was this year what I needed? Yes.
Yeah.
Because it got rid of that voice.
And once the voice goes, all the doors open, don't they?
Yes, absolutely. You're entirely correct on that. All the doors open. You kind of find a power that you always want and wished you had, but you always did have. It was just locked behind a door that voice was covering.
Yes, you touch the edge of the cookie cutter to go back to your previous analogy.
Yeah, 100% correct, yeah.
So what I'm interested to know with your English teacher job is how is your spelling now and how does that work being an English teacher?
I'm incredibly open, literally from the first lesson with my students. And I will just turn around and go, I will be teaching you English this year. However, I am also severely dyslexic.
And I bet they're like, what?
Yes, yeah. They were like, what? How can you do this? I was like, I am going to teach you all the stuff that I know that makes my life easier.
Yes.
If you want an easy life, I mean, I like an easy life. Do you like an easy life? And they're all like, yes. It's like, right, let's work together.
Brilliant.
And basically just kind of like teach them tricks that I've picked up. And things that kind of help me, but they all know that I am dyslexic. And there's been times when I've had a very bad dyslexic day and one of the kids has asked me a spelling and I'm like, and literally it just goes, the dyslexia's kicked in, the brain has gone, the spelling is nowhere in sight.
Yeah.
And I'm going back to my laptop to type it in. And the kids went, Phil, I've got this. And another student has kind of helped somebody else.
Excellent. Because I glean from what we said earlier, your class tends to be full of students that have struggled or failed at English before.
Yeah. So at the college, they are resitting their GCSE while at college.
Actually, you're probably really good place to be because you know what it's like to struggle through English rather than having, shall we say, a neurotypical teacher that may have possibly had a GCSE level that's like, well, you just do this. You're like, well, clearly that doesn't work. So how about these four other techniques that work for me?
Yes, might work for you. Yeah, just being incredibly honest and at times holding my hands up and going, right, I am having a very dyslexic day. So everything that I am currently talking about or putting up on the board, like writing up on the board, I will double check.
Yes.
So they know I'm not perfect, but they know that it's okay to go back through and check their own work.
Yep. Yeah. That's a misheld belief I hang on to my late 30s. Like everybody else just types an email and hits go. No, they don't.
No, they read through multiple times.
Yeah.
Like I also have when I use PowerPoint slides, it's inverted. So it's a black background with gray writing.
Yeah. Cut down the visual stress.
Yeah. So it helps me. And then I can actually read it out, but I found it helps a lot of the other students as well. And just being incredibly open and honest and just going, I am dyslexic. This is what happens. I mean, a lot of them will ask me a spelling and they know now that if I don't have a pen in my hand, I'll use my finger and write the spelling out on the desk.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then as I'm doing it, spell it for them.
Yes. Yes. Do you find your brain fills in the ink on the desk or is that just me?
No, it does. It fills the income desk as I'm moving my finger across the desk. Yeah. It works.
Yeah.
The first few times a student see me do that, they're like, what's he doing? Like, what? But now they're just used to me doing it.
I find that AirPen has beautiful handwriting.
Yeah, it really does. But one of the things I found is I spotted one of my students doing it.
Right. Yes.
And I was like, oh, wow. So it was quite interesting that they were doing it using the finger pen with a beautiful handwriting and then writing it in.
How are the parents with you being dyslexic and teaching them English? Do you get any pushback that way?
I've never experienced that. Okay. I don't know if the parents do know, but I've never come across it.
No, I was curious because I thought they come home, they're studying at home, or, hey, I've learned this new technique today, and they're like, well, that's a bit out there.
I've never had it. Granted, when I go back, I might end up having a question with someone, but it just depends. I think during one of the enrollment processes, a lot of the parents are like, oh, you're dyslexic. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah,
good, and then turn good. Around to the kid and go, well, if he can do it, you can do it.
Yeah.
And you kind of like at times become not so much a stick that the kid, they kind of like hit the kid with, but it's like, well, he'll teach you. He'll show you how you can move forward with it.
Or a role model than stick.
Yes. Sometimes it comes across as I'm being used as a stick. but it's role model. I don't quite know how I feel about that particular statement. It's a bit weird, but I think that's the Paul Praise thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I genuinely just think it's like, with dyslexia, it's an apprenticeship.
Yes.
It's just lifelong.
Yes, I like that analogy. It's quite interesting, a lifelong apprenticeship. I was about to say we should be all lifelong learners, whether dyslexic or not. Continuous improvement and learning new skills during life is important.
100% important. I mean, if you stop learning, in my mind, you stop living. Because every time you go on holiday, you're learning about a new country, you're learning about a new culture, you're experiencing things. And it's about kind of taking yourself out of that bubble every so often. And that's learning. And you don't just have to have a book in front of you to be learning.
No, certainly not. They are good resources, particularly if they're in audio form. But there are millions of ways to learn.
See, I can't do audio books.
Can you not? See, I can't do paper books.
No. So I can't follow along with an audio book.
Oh, interesting. But you quite enjoy reading, don't you? I've got
no time for the reading.
No, not at all. Lots of damage there.
Yeah. No, it's interesting how it works. Like I daydream I have tried listening to an audiobook, but I daydream and then like three chapters have gone by and I have no idea what I've just listened to.
Ah, yes. Yes. Fair enough.
I've been too busy in my head.
Yeah. 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 I could see that. I mean, I tend to do it while driving and stuff, but yeah, I could see that. And I sometimes can do a little bit of book, and Amazon Kindle was game changer for me in terms of reading, but yes. I am envious of these people who can get lost in a book for 3 hours.
Yeah, I was one of those kids growing up that would literally just sit, and everywhere I went, I took a book and would just literally sit and read continuously because it was the world in my head was so vivid.
Yeah.
That it created that I loved living in that world in my head.
So you clearly have no problem so much with reading, it's getting it back out again. Onto the page of spelling.
Yes. Yeah. It's getting it out in a consistent manner that wasn't what one of my friends called a brain vomit.
Okay.
And being able to just like, I used to just empty my head of everything and it didn't have any structure. It didn't have any kind of like logical sequencing. It was just everything all at once on the page. Like, but that happens with me with my speech as well.
Okay.
So my dyslexia can impact my speech.
Oh, right.
So I can, depending on how stressed I am, I can merge words into, like just slam words together.
Yeah.
Swap words around in sentences without realizing that I'm doing that. At times talk like Yoda. And at one point, I was shouting at a student when I worked in the secondary school. He had to put his hand up while I was shouting at him. It was like, Phil, you're speaking backwards.
Oh, God. Right.
And I didn't realize that I'd started speaking backwards. So I had to calm myself down enough to then start shouting at him all over again.
Forwards. You'd rather record this and play it in reverse.
Yes. But he was dyslexic himself, so he found it really funny.
Which is not good when you try to tell somebody off if they find it funny.
No, not good. Yeah. But it was actually quite... And we still talk about it if we bump into each other. And it was like, he turned around and was like, at the time, it was funny, but it was really kind of like humanizing to see how it affected you. But yeah, it can like impact my speech because the thoughts just come that quick.
Yes. Yeah. So they just go into one continuous. Yeah,
just all at once. And I just can't keep up with it at times. And it just kind of merges into one kind of like conglomerate word. And it's just, it's bizarre at times, but you just kind of learn to go with it.
Yeah, you do, don't you? Sometimes you just have to roll with the punches or learn to take a breath or something like that just to kind of bring it down to a lower simmer, I suppose.
Yes.
So I want to talk about your website now, Our Dyslexia Connection. Where did the idea for that come about?
I'm not entirely sure. It was just one of those things that I'd kind of like been percolating over. Mm. And it just popped into my head when I was daydreaming. And it kind of took fruition very, very rapidly. It was one of those moments where the mind just kind of takes over and everything was kind of set within about a minute in my head. Yeah. To explain it, like, I've already said that I'm gay and dyslexic. One part of me has this amazing community of fiercely loyal, loving, supportive people who champion LGBT, who are there, regardless of whether you want them or not, they are there for you. If you engage with them or not, they are there for you. And you don't have to go to Pride, but they are there for you. Where dyslexics, there isn't really a community. There is small pockets of people around the country that if you're in the know, you know where they are and you know who they are, but you've got to be in the know.
Mm.
But there's no cohesive community of people that are going, we're here for you, and this is what it's like.
Mm.
And it was my way of kind of gathering voices, not just of millionaires and billionaires and people that have made it to the Oscars and all people like that. And you think, well, that's like the 1%.
Yes, yes.
Like, it's lovely that you got there. Well done. I'm proud of you. But at no point do I want to be an actor or a singer.
Yeah.
And there wasn't, for the lack of a better term, and I hate the term, real people with air quotes that people could look up to.
Mm. Yes. Yes. It's one of the drivers behind this podcast series. It's shamelessly for the younger me, but there's a big disconnect between Richard Branson here and somebody who's just finished school here. Like, what are the accountants, the lawyers, the engineers? All of these people are also dyslexic, and this is how it works.
Yes. But there was never anything that kind of humanized them.
Mm.
So there was no way that, and also a lot of it, annoyingly, was written.
Yes.
So there's lots of accounts of dyslexic people being dyslexic that are written down. And I'm thinking, well, the format is written. I mean, you're dealing with dyslexics, but you're writing it in a form that dyslexics don't really like, stereotypically.
Yep.
How does that work?
Yep. Yes.
Like, it was just bizarre. It harkened back to, like, I had flashbacks when I was thinking about it to that group where here's the dictionary book and you're all going to use it.
Yeah.
Well, it's not a strategy that we're all going to use.
No. Yeah, know your target audience. So it was just,
know the target audience. Pitch it to the target audience. Stereotypically, we don't like reading.
Oh, yes.
Why put it in reading form? So it was just creating a video and turning the mobile phone horizontal so anyone can do it. They've got to be over the age of 18. Mm-hmm. And just share your story. What would you tell your younger self? what have you learned about it? What's been the highs? What's been the lows? And what could you tell people? And it's not just dyslexic people, that dyslexic people's stories that I'm after. It's parents as well. They've equally got a massive role to play in it.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's also professionals. So teachers, ed psychs, anybody that has any relation to dyslexia. So that when a young dyslexic person who just finds out, whether they're 16, 21, 22, like I am, or in their 30s, and they think, well, what is it? There's a huge raft of videos of real people that you can look at, that you can talk to, that you can look and think, they're just like me. And they're doing all sorts of different jobs. And if you're a parent and you find out that your son or your daughter is dyslexic and you're thinking, oh my God, are they going to ever make anything of themselves? Where can I go? How do I feel? Well, go listen to the dyslexic people stories. Go listen to parents who have been through that exact same thought process.
Yeah. Yeah.
What have they done? What have they helped themselves with? So then the parents are feeling as if they've got people just like them.
Yeah.
And then the professionals. So when new teachers are learning, because the teacher training process is horrific when it comes to SEN. You've got all those people talking about their dyslexia, other teachers that are sharing with you strategies that you can make
yes.
for your students.
Yeah.
And you've got those videos that you could share with some of your classes. So it's kind of like coming at it in a few different ways to be able to encapsulate a community, because we're all connected by it. And it's a way of just connecting to that other person, regardless of whether or not you see them ever again, or whether or not you walk past them every day, but they don't know that you've watched their video, and you then become, or they become your role model. Because they've watched you, and they want to become a designer of cars. So they watch your video because you've been there, and they think, well, if they can do it, I can do it. And it's having that ability just to inspire, but turning, and again, I hate the word, everyday people into those role models, into those people of inspiration. Because that's what we want to see. We want to see genuine authenticity from people. And we want to see, like, everyone's watching everybody. Not in a weird way, but when somebody falls down, we want to see them how they get back up. Because when they get back up, it inspires us. And when they get up, we can get back up.
Yeah, it is. It's sometimes, to quote Rocky Balboa, it's not about how hard you can hit, it's how hard you can get hit and keep moving.
Yeah, and keep moving forward. And being able to step into yourself. And sometimes you've got to look at somebody else and think, well, if they can do it, I can do it, until you're ready to then do it for yourself. So you use that other person, you use that person in that video and think, because they've done it, I can do it.
Yeah, gets rid of the I can't be an English teacher.
Yeah, or whatever it is that you want to go into, a joiner or a mechanic, an engineer or a doctor or a nurse or whatever that is, because that person's walked that path, they can.
Yeah. It sounds like a wonderful resource. And
it's a grand cheesy plan.
Grand cheesy plan.
Yeah, that's what I call it. It's my grand cheesy plan. I mean, but if it works and it pulls it off and it becomes a good resource, brilliant.
Yeah. What is your future plans for growing it? Have you got any sort of direction you want to take it in?
Just gathering more and more videos. At the moment, there is ways that I'd like it to go. I'd love to be able to go out and speak at different places. Mm-hmm. In the future, I'd quite like it to develop where you can become a forum.
Oh, yes.
So you can kind of have things listed.
Mm.
And you can go in and say if you are in the Northeast, well, you have all the Northeast coaches.
Ah, yes, yes.
On there. If you go in and you look at, I don't know, Wales, you can have a look at wherever all of the coaches and all the different people are in Wales. Yeah. I'd love at some point to do my PhD.
Oh, wow, cool. What do you do it in?
Just dyslexia, but kind of expanding on my master's dissertation. So identity, how the creation of story and community helps to kind of create identity. So how we actually are able to create a community of different voices then impacts upon self-esteem, self-confidence, and identity.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, yeah. Well, hopefully you get to do that. That'd be fascinating, maybe, to catch up with you after you've done the PhD and see how your thoughts have changed.
Yeah, that would be fun. It'd be really interesting to do that. And I have actually been talking to a potential supervisor for it.
Excellent. Sounds like you've got the wheels rolling.
It is. It's slowly starting at the moment.
But I always find overcoming the initial inertia is the hardest bit. And then once it starts gathering some momentum, away you go.
Yes. Yeah, that's what I'm kind of struggling with at the moment with the website. It's having those fits and starts of it lurches forward a little bit and it stops. And then it lurches again and it stops. And I'm just kind of waiting for that moment where it begins to go into first gear and moves a little bit faster than normal. If we're going to carry on the car analogy.
Yes. Yeah, such an engineer analogy.
Yes.
Right. I'm going to start winding up the podcast now. And every guest that comes on here gets 3 rapid fire questions from me. They don't need fast answers from you, but they're quick questions from me. So my first question is, what prejudice have you had about dyslexia that's been proven wrong?
Why are you becoming an English teacher when you can't? Probably would be the first one.
Yeah.
Can you? And then also along the lines of, hold on, you're dyslexic, but you read. I'm like, yeah, I can read. It might not be overly quick, but I can read. It's like, we don't just avoid it. We do cry. Like, and then it's kind of that sideways head tilt that I mentioned before, where it's like, oh, bless you. But the main prejudice tends to come from, it's not prejudice, but misbelief from other dyslexics. Of people thinking they're cursed, people thinking they're broken, or like one person genuinely did think that she'd cursed her grandchild because she was dyslexic. And her grandchild had just been found out to be dyslexic and she was like, I've cursed him. Jeez. It's like, you haven't. It's not. Like, that's a hell of a lot of guilt and a hell of a lot of shame.
That is really bad, isn't it?
Yeah. But that's kind of like the language that can get used.
Yeah,
it can.
Yeah. And the language you hang on to for far too long.
Yeah. Yes.
Wow. Okay. So, next question is, if an alien came down and you had to describe dyslexia to them, how would you do it?
It's a different way of thinking. We think in pictures rather than in words. And it teaches us a very different way of viewing the world. And we have insights and ideas that change the world. It's a power that you need to learn how to use. It has its negatives and its positives. And it's no way a superpower.
Hmm.
It's just a gift that you have to be able to utilize.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I might, if it was kind of like an alien had already seen Harry Potter or Star Wars, I'd mention those two. Because you need a place to learn how to utilize those gifts.
Yeah, you need to learn how to wield it, so to speak.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, and the final question for me on the podcast, seeing as this is the Dyslexia Life Hacks show, what is your favorite dyslexia life hack?
For me, it would be the fact that my phone talks to my Mac and my phone and Mac talk to my watch. If I didn't have that, I would not be organized in the slightest.
I see.
So everything talks to everything else. If it doesn't go in the phone or in the calendar, it doesn't happen.
Yes, yes.
Because that keeps me organized. And another good thing would be speech to text, being able just to kind of like get rid of those thoughts onto page and then go through them and kind of filter them.
Yeah. Stop the restriction that is your arm or yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a tool I use a lot as well.
Empty the head.
That's it. Yeah. Right fast, right bad, right wrong, and then edit it later.
Yes. Yeah. Basically just empty the head, get everything down, and then go back through it.
Oh, cool. So before I finally sign off, is there anything else you'd like to add? Or where can people find you? Or if they want to submit videos to your website, how do they go about it?
So if you want to go onto the website, it's www.ourdyslexicconnection.co.uk. And there is a form that you would end up filling in just so you can actually put down what you want to talk about. And then I get back to you and we have just a bit of discussion through that. I also watch every single video that is given to me. Because if someone goes to the trouble of being incredibly vulnerable and opening themselves up and sharing a story that is incredibly emotional and incredibly empowering, but also with elements of trust and just pure vulnerability, at least for me, the least I can do is do that person the honor and privilege. Well, not privilege, that's right. I'm privileged to be watching their video.
Yeah.
And then I upload it. And it's just having where they are in the world and their first name. And I remove all the comments so you don't get any nasty comments on YouTube. It's a very safe place. There's never any comments going to be out.
Okay.
I don't want that. And then we just upload it and you add to those stories. And over time, you can watch the others. And I'm building on Twitter, and that's at Dyslexic Connect. Mm-hmm. And then also on Instagram, and that's just Our Dyslexic Connection.
Cool.
And yes, and at some point, I'm going to not do the whole TikTok dancing. That's a bit too far, but I will be setting up the TikToks and getting into that. Apparently, that's a good thing.
Apparently so. Yes.
But there will be no dancing from me.
Fair enough. Well, thank you for taking the time, Phil, to join the show. It's been really interesting hearing the stories, particularly getting to the weeds about all the psychology of it. Some bits I was finding hard to listen to. And it really sort of touched me at points. So it's been really interesting talking to you. And I want to thank everybody else for listening. And I will see you guys in the next episode. Goodbye for now.